Hello, and welcome to MomsFightingAutism.com. You're on the conference Get Educated About Autism. It's a conference put on by MomsFightingAutism.com and also co-sponsored by AutismCollege.com, of which I'm the founder. My name is Chantal Cecile Kira. And today, right now, is supposed to take place a presentation with Areva Martin, who I'm trying to reach right now because she's not on the line. So hopefully she'll be on in a few minutes. So right now I will introduce her to you. I hope that everyone can see the slides that are up on the screen. And you see there's a place to ask questions. So if you don't see the slides right now, you can type in and mention that. Okay. So, Areva. Areva Martin is the author of The Everyday Advocate, Standing Up for Your Child with Autism. And she is an attorney. Areva has her own special needs network as well, which is a nonprofit. She's a nationally recognized legal authority and expert on autism who appears regularly on the Dr. Phil show and has been featured on many other radio and television shows. A Harvard-educated attorney, she has helped hundreds of families gain access to services and develop coherent programs for their children with autism. She served as the vice chair of the California Blue Ribbon Commission on Autism's Professional Development and Education Committee and is the co-founder and president of the nonprofit Special Needs Network Incorporated. She lives in Los Angeles. Sorry, she lives in Los Angeles. Can you tell I've been doing this since 8 o'clock this morning as well since yesterday at 8 o'clock in the morning? She lives in Los Angeles with her husband and three children, including a 10-year-old son who has autism. Maybe I should just stop reading and just start talking. I was actually trying to find the other more complete information that I have about Areva, who is a very talented and educated person. I am lucky enough to have met her in working with the Senate Autism Committee on issues relating to autism. Let's see, what else is in here about her? She's an accomplished and multi-award-winning attorney, syndicated columnist. She's an author and public speaker who has also been featured on the pages of publications ranging from the New York Times to Ebony Magazine to Redbook and the LA Times. The founding and managing partner of Martin & Martin, LLP, Areva was selected as one of Los Angeles' top attorneys by LA Focus. So she's also a sought-after legal expert and an inspiring author. As you all know, as I've just told you about the Everyday Advocate, Standing Up for Your Child with Autism. I don't hear Areva on the line yet, so I have my daughter on her telephone trying to reach Areva's office, and we will see what's happening. But meanwhile, I have her book here, and I can tell you that the topic today is the special education puzzle, knowing your rights and how to navigate federal and state education laws in order to achieve success for your special needs child. So while I was sitting here waiting for Areva, I have been also looking through her book, which I've had for some time, and I really love this book. And I have decided that I'm going to look at one area here that I think is extremely important that I can speak to you about because I may not be cognizant of the laws in the way, of course, that Areva Martin is, but I know that there are some strategies that are really important in terms of advocating for your child. And one of the important aspect is being prepared. In other words, you want to make sure that you have your documents in order so that you have proof of everything that you are asking for. And so it's good to have a good organization system. So here are 8 tips from Ariva about achieving better organization. This is from page 62 in the Everyday Advocate. She says, never open a general file. Keeping several inboxes can be useful if you go through them every week. A general file labeled therapy or medical is better than nothing but just barely. 2, create an index. A directory of your file folders, whether handwritten or logged on your computer, is easy to update and invaluable for helping you find files. Make sure it's easily accessible anytime you look for a file. Use divisions. Assume that many of your files will be filled. Plan ahead for that. Decide whether you would prefer to break large files into smaller categories or assign them different volume numbers. 4, leave extra space. An overfilled box or cabinet is unwieldy. Always leave space to move files in and out easily. Allow room for growth. If necessary, cull files by throwing them out or putting them in a separate archive. These sound like really basic tips, but they're very important. And I've filed a due process twice for my son Jeremy, and I can tell you that with 2 different school districts, and I can tell you that one of the main reasons I was able to win was because I had documented everything. But the thing is, you may document everything, but if you can't retrieve it, then it's really no good for you. So this organization aspect is very important. And of course, I feel guilty because in my office right now, my papers are not necessarily organized as well as they should be today, but you can be certain that if I'm going to file for due process or do any such thing, my papers will be in order. Archiving old information is tip number 5. Depending on the space available, you may consider keeping the files from one school year in a readily accessible place. Box and label the files from previous school years. You may still need to refer to them, but you do not necessarily have to keep them at hand. Identify temporary papers. Flyers for meetings, special notices, address change cards, and other papers can be thrown out after they've been attended to. Add a post-it or colored dot to these papers indicating their expiration date so you can throw them out without hesitation. Keep the files safe. Be sure to keep your file system accurate or secure. Consider using filing cabinets with locks or elevating them off the ground to avoid water damage. That's a really good tip. Make filing a habit. Decide on a systematic way to keep your filing system intact, then promise yourself you'll do it, whether it is filing daily or weekly or as soon as documents arrive. Not many people enjoy it, but everyone appreciates being able to find important documents when they need them. It's an invaluable habit, and I totally agree. I had gotten into the habit of filing every Friday because Friday was a day where it's the end of the week and I'm not going to be taken off on any great writing projects at that point. And so it kind of feels like I can do that kind of work that I don't consider work, but that is really important for everything. I consider it work in the sense of it's stuff that has to be done, but it's not the work that either helps me get information out to people about autism, which is my passion, and it doesn't help me with writing my books, which is another one of my great passions. It doesn't always help me with everything that I need for Jeremy right away, but it does in the long run. So I highly agree that when you're doing these jobs that are not so fun, that you have a system whereby you say you're going to file once a week at a certain time on the same day, and you just get in the habit of doing it. Well, I don't see Ariva getting on the line anytime soon. In case there's anybody here online, I'm going to go ahead and flip through the slides. Quite a few of them here. Is there anybody actually online? Can you type in and tell me if you're online? Because if you're online, I will continue to go through these slides. But if there's no one there, then I will not. Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and end this webinar to try and find out what has happened to Ariva. Thank you.
The moderator has left the conference.
Hello, everyone. Ernest. Hello. Hello. Hello?
The moderator has left the conference.
Okay, we are expecting Areva momentarily. I got off the line to find out more about where she is, and she's actually been here, called into another number. So hopefully she'll be back on here in a minute. So thanks for your patience. Hello? Yes. Okay. 309. 0952. Okay. Okay, thanks. Bye. Areva, this is Chantel. Good, I've been online reading from your book. And then I stopped 10 minutes ago because I was thinking maybe you were having a problem coming on, and then Ernest called after I got off the webinar. No, I didn't have your number. What I did is I did for everyone, which I thought you had the instructions. I didn't have your personal number. I was calling. We're supposed to call in and check each other for the on the webinar number. So I called into the webinar number and waited and waited and waited. And then I'm sorry about the communication. Obviously, there's been miscommunication. Yeah, and he meant she'll call on the webinar line. So I'll walk you through it, okay? And we can still continue doing it because even if people don't sign on, he can replay it at another time, and that's what they'll do. So I was reading from your book on how to organize your files. I figured I'm not talking about the laws, okay? Okay, so... Okay, so what you need to do is you call on a landline on 949-3, correct, right, can you do that? Do you have a landline? It's better on a landline. Okay, so do you have something to, okay. 333-4806. And then when you get on, it'll say that you're in a conference, and it'll say that you need to put in the conference ID number. So it's a PIN number. Here's the number, 7022-59, and then the pound sign. And that'll connect it so people can hear us, but they can't talk to us. But they can hear us talking, and they can hear us either through the Internet or through their phone. Okay, so that's the first part. What you need to do, are you on the conference panel itself? Teleseminar page or no? Okay, do you see your slides? Yes, but first I want to know, do you see your slides? Okay, you don't. Okay, no, you don't want to go to the side. Do you see on the top where it says slides? That's the one you want. Correct. Okay, and then what you do is you move them by the little arrow on the bottom. So you're going to be in control of the slides, and I will be checking the questions and answer questions that people are sending in. So you don't worry about... and. Talk through the slides, but if you pause once in a while, then I'll ask you a question if there's a question from somebody, or I'll make a comment just from a personal point of view, because that makes it more personal for people, too. Is that okay with you? Yes, go right ahead. Okay, can you hear me over the phone, the landline? Ariva? Ariva, I don't hear you over the landline. No, because that's for...
Okay, now hello?
Now I got you. Okay, I'm going to hang up the cell phone, but be advised that everyone can hear you now.
Okay.
Okay, so I'm going to... For those who
start
are...
now.
I'll introduce you.
Okay.
So I'm just... Give a couple seconds for the editing so we can clean this up later. Good afternoon. This is Chantel Cecile Kira, and I'm here for MomsFightingAutism.com for the conference, Get Educated About Autism. I'm also the founder of AutismCollege.com, and it is my pleasure today to introduce our next speaker, Ariva Martin, who is an attorney. And she is also the author of The Everyday Advocate. Ariva Martin is a nationally recognized legal authority and expert on autism who appears regularly, on the Dr. Phil Show and has been featured on many other radio and television programs. A Harvard-educated attorney, she has helped hundreds of families gain access to services and develop coherent programs for their children with autism. She served as the vice chair of the California Blue Ribbon Commission on Autism's Professional Development and Education Committee and is the co-founder and president of the nonprofit Special Needs Network, Incorporated. She lives in Los Angeles with her husband and three children, including a 10-year-old son who has autism. Welcome, Ariva.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be a part of today's program.
Yeah, you know, I wanted to ask you to talk a little bit more about the Special Needs Network before you get started on your topic for today.
Yes, the Special Needs Network is a 501c nonprofit organization, which I started about 6 years ago. I was very concerned about families, particularly those in underserved communities, and their ability to access services and to really be in the know about what was happening medically and what was happening around intervention services and a lot of the policies that impact children with special needs. So the organization provides grassroots advocacy training. It provides resources. It provides an actual direct service component to kids with autism, including a summer camp program and after-school programs. And it really serves as a connection to link families in underserved communities with more mainstream organizations and to link them with resources. And we do a variety of things, including town hall meetings, resource fairs, health fairs, and conferences to really educate families about, you know, what's available and how they, too, can take advantage of the many services and programs that are out there to help their children.
You have one coming up, don't you?
Yes, on April 15th and 16th, we have our annual parent and professional conference. This is the largest autism conference sponsored in South Los Angeles. It's free to parents and professionals. We attract over 1,000 participants over 2 days. It starts with a huge legislative breakfast on Friday, April 15th, where we invite over 50 local and state elected officials to come out. We have about five or six that are actual speakers on our presentation, and they talk about pending legislation and bills that impact the autism and disability community. And then on Saturday the 16th, we have 16 workshops, a resource fair, and you know, just a ton of information that we provide. This year, Autism Speaks is one of our co-sponsors, so they're actually going to be giving away over 200 of their 100-day kits. We also have one of our board members that's donated several iPads, so we're going to do a raffle so some lucky families will go home with a couple of iPads. So it's just going to be a wonderful, like I said, free conference. Ricky Robinson is going to be doing her first L.A. book signing of her new book that's just come out. We just have a myriad of professionals, nationally recognized professionals, who will be sharing information and providing resources to families. So folks interested can go to our website, www.specialneedsnetwork.org, and register for the conference and just get information about what the organization is doing.
That sounds great. And thank you so much for taking the time to be here. I know we got started a little late because of technical problems, and I apologize.
My pleasure. I'm always excited, very excited to be a part of what you're doing, because you're so active in our community and do so much to bring resources and information to families. And I just think this is a fantastic idea. I'm a big, big advocate of using technology to reach families. So I applaud you and Moms Fighting Autism for this fantastic program. Glad to be a part of it.
I'm hoping that either through Moms Fighting Autism or through AutismCollege.com to be able to offer some of these webinars in Spanish. That's my next goal for myself personally, because I know, at least living down here in San Diego near the border, there's not that much information available in Spanish, and there is such a great need, and especially in terms of knowing your legal rights. It's very important.
Very important, and again, we talk about underserved communities, and that's what when I said I started Special Needs Network, definitely families who are not fluent in English, or, you know, English is not their first or primary language, really struggle in this arena, because we know, particularly with your legal rights, it can be pretty complex, even for those, you know, that do speak English, if you're not an attorney or an advocate. So having this information translated in Spanish is going to be incredibly useful to thousands of families across this country, hundreds of thousands. So kudos
nice
to you for
have
that.
You back on then. So maybe we'll have you back on then.
Be fantastic. Would love to. Whenever there's an opportunity to do so, just reach out to me.
Okay. So would you like to go ahead and start with your slides? And I'll be negotiating to see when there are questions coming up, and I'll jump in and ask you when it's appropriate.
Okay, fantastic. So this afternoon we're talking about, you know, the legal aspects of, you know, really helping a child thrive. And as you all know, most of this is going to come up in the context of IEPs, or, you know, getting a child either in school or navigating the system once a child enters public school. So this presentation is called Achieving Success in Special Education and Understanding IDEA. So we're going to spend some time just talking about what IDEA is and what is really important for parents to know. As Chantel introduced me, I am an attorney. I run a law practice in the Los Angeles area. I was fortunate enough last year to write a book called The Everyday Advocate, Standing Up for Your Child with Autism and Other Special Needs. The book was published by Penguin last April and just came out in paperback this April. And it's really a comprehensive step-by-step guide for parents looking to learn the concept, the process of advocacy. In my legal practice, I dedicate an entire department to special education, school law, discrimination, disability, and labor and employment. I've had the good fortune of representing hundreds of families in complex disability discrimination cases and school bullying cases, IEPs, mediations, and hearings. So in addition to the work I do as an advocate, I also, in my legal practice, myself and several lawyers in my practice represent families in both state and federal court and in administrative claims. So we're going to talk about IDEA, and for those of you who may be new to this area, IDEA is the federal law that governs a child's right to special education in the public school setting. Now, depending on what state you're in, most states have a state educational code that also governs special educational rights. So it's really important for you to, you can ask your school district if you don't have access to an advocate or an attorney for some citation or copies of where you can find what the educational code in your particular state says about special education. But IDEA was enacted in 1975. We actually had its 20-year anniversary in 2005. And again, like I said, this is a federal statute, so enacted by, you know, U.S. government, the Congress, the U.S. Congress, to address issues of public education and the entitlement to special education. And what's so important to me when I talk about IDEA is just how recent it is as a law that our children with special needs actually had federal protection by statute. So prior to 1975, and I actually know some families who have kids who were in public school prior to that, they didn't have this law. They didn't have this federal law mandating that their children receive special education. And I've had families tell me they couldn't enroll their children even in their local public schools. So we are incredibly grateful as parents, and I happen to be a parent. I have a son that's on the spectrum, and he receives public education from a local public school in the Los Angeles area. So not only as a professional, as a parent who, you know, is involved with this on a personal level, I know the value of, you know, having this federal statute available. Right. We're not going to get into a lot of the technical parts of it, but I just want to give parents, I want to give advocates a general overview so that they'll be comfortable at IEP meetings, they'll know the right language to use, they'll know the right questions to ask. So Section 1400 of IDEA defines its purpose, and it's really important, I think, that parents understand the purpose of IDEA. And it says to ensure a free, appropriate public education. And that term, free, appropriate public education, is often abbreviated and called FAPE, F-A-P-E. So at school meetings and in the context of public education, you'll often hear the word, you know, is this FAPE or is the offer of services FAPE? Does it meet FAPE? And that's what FAPE stands for, free, appropriate public education. So,
Ariva,
yes.
I'm not seeing the slides move, and our listeners aren't either. Are you using the sidebar or are you using on the bottom the little arrow?
I'm using the arrow at the bottom.
Okay. Which slide are you on? Because we have...
Three.
Okay. No, I don't see slide three on here. Okay.
Yes, I'm using the arrow, and it's moving them.
Okay.
Well, just, you want me to do something else?
No, I'm just checking on my end here. It seems to be going okay, too. But maybe now, maybe it just took a while to load for the people who just signed on. Go ahead and continue, Ariva. Thank you.
Okay. So, again, 1400 defines the purpose of IDEA to ensure a free, appropriate public education to meet the unique needs, and the rest of that language talks about the unique needs of a child with a special or qualifying condition. And this is the really important language, and I have it in bold, to prepare, and just assume we insert the word, prepare a child for further education, employment, and independent living. So the reason that's so important is because when you're at an IEP and when you're developing an independent educational program for a child, that should be the question you're always asking yourself. Is this IEP, are the services contained in this IEP, are they designed to prepare my child, and let's personalize it, for further education, employment, and independent living? So imagine if we're talking about a child in the ninth grade, the question is this program designed to prepare this child further education would mean for college, or some other kind of post-secondary education? Is it designed to prepare him or her for employment and or independent living? And if it's not meeting, you know, those standards, it's not further education, employment, or independent living, then it's not a well-designed IEP, and you've got to go back to the drawing board. So that's really, again, the driving question. The next slide talks about FAPE, this term FAPE, and IDEA. It doesn't define what FAPE is, but we have a very important Supreme Court, and again, we're talking U.S. Supreme Court case. It's called the Board of Education v. Rowley, and you will often hear references to this case. And in legal arenas, cases take on significance, and particularly those that are decided by the highest court in the land, the U.S. Supreme Court. So think again of at your local level, you have state courts, and then you have federal district courts, you have federal appellate courts, and at the top of the pyramid is the United States Supreme Court. So a case that starts in a state court and very, very few cases make their way all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. But once a case does make it that far, that case has significant ramification and significance in the sense that it becomes the guiding principle, the guiding law, and it trumps in many ways other cases that may have been decided in those lower courts. So Rowley concludes that FAPE doesn't mean the best program, nor is it designed to maximize a child's potential or learning. And what you sometimes will hear used in the public school or public education context is that a child with special education isn't entitled to a Cadillac. So it doesn't have to be a Cadillac of services, as long as the services are designed to provide academic progress. That's all that the law requires. So,
And isn't it true that a lot of the discussions that go on are really about what does it mean by a fair and appropriate education? Because people can argue that case about
absolutely good point. Because the IDEA statute itself does not define for us what FAPE is, it's left to the interpretation of case law and judges. And Rowley has become that standard, which tells us that it's not the best program. So often parents or school districts will say what we're offering is adequate, it's sufficient, may not be the best, but it does meet, you know, the basic standards of IDEA. And it's subject to lots of interpretations, and you'll see lots of, you know, opinions on both sides of whether a particular program does indeed meet the standards of FAPE as defined. On the slides going forward, I try to provide some tip for parents. And the tip is, you know, when you're in one of these IEP meetings, as much as we know we want the best program for our kids, because as parents we always want the best, you don't want to use that language because the statute doesn't talk about best. And nor does this controlling case, Rowley, talk about best. So as an advocate, you want to get strategic. You want to be strategic in your use of language and talk about appropriate, because that's the language that is used in the statute, and that's the standard that has been set. Now, again, appropriate, you know, is a highly complex term, and just like best, appropriate also is subject to interpretation. But you want to start to use that language, which puts you, you know, in the context of what the school is obligated to do. So rather than saying to a school, I want the best program for my child, you know, I want an appropriate program. I want a program that's designed to maximize my, I want a program that's designed to prepare my child for that further education, employment, and independent living, because, again, that's going to put you in solid ground in terms of the statute. And so moving on to the next slide, and what I tried to do was pull out some of the key points in IDEA, and these are some of the issues that I've seen come up that parents, again, you know, often have questions about, because we know the next slide talks about the teachers and what are the requirements that teachers have in terms of their education and training. Because, you know, we hear all the time, I like that classroom, but I don't like the teacher, or I don't think the teacher is qualified. And IDEA, as revised, 2004, attempted to address, again, the question of teacher credentials and teacher standards. And what it tells us that is that teachers who teach core academic subjects must meet standards of, in this case, NCLB, is No Child Left Behind, and have state certification. And usually this isn't under the TIPS section. This usually isn't a problem in bigger districts, but can be in some smaller school districts and in non-public schools. So you always want to ask, you know, what is the teacher's qualifications, particularly those who are teaching core academic subjects.
I did want to say that a few people are writing in that they are having a problem seeing the slides. Other people are seeing the slides, so I wanted to know, Ariva, because they're asking, do we have permission to give the slides to the people who have had a problem finding it online?
Yes, and I'm so sorry that we're having this technical issue because I'm looking at the slides and they're advancing.
I see the slides too, but some people are not, so I'm not
No,
quite
feel
sure
free to publish them. Feel free to make them available to those that have signed on and unfortunately don't have the ability to see them because I want everyone to see them and to take advantage of them.
I'll make sure that happens.
Okay. The next slide talks about, and again, this is all revised IDEA 2004, parents, and it did provide us with a new definition, and parents now do or does, the term parents includes adoptive, grandparent, or other relative with whom the child lives. So anyone who's legally responsible for a child, and again, if you're not the biological parent, but you're the guardian of a child that has special education services, you want to make sure that you can establish that you have legal rights to make educational decisions. This comes up, Chantel, sometimes in the context of divorce and separation, and particularly when you have a custody battle, and a child may be living with a parent, and it's always important for parents going through a divorce, and a part of my legal practice, we also handle family law matters, is to have the court determine very clearly who has educational rights, because it's that parent with the educational rights that can make decisions, such as signing an IEP and making decisions about placement for the child in, you know, a classroom. So you might be the custodial parent, but that doesn't necessarily mean you have the educational rights. So if you're a parent going through a divorce or a separation, you want to, again, make sure that in your legal document, you know, that determines custody, that the educational rights are clearly defined. Often they are granted to both parents in a divorce situation, and they have to make joint decisions about a child. But sometimes a court will, maybe for geographic reasons, give the ed rights to only one parent. So, again, just something to know.
That's very important information.
Yes, and it's often overlooked, and family law courts don't often realize the ramifications of some of their decision-making as it relates to the educational setting. And I've had, again, cases where parents, again, may have the physical custody of a child, but the educational rights are shared with both parents, and they've gone in and have tried to make a decision, and it legally they don't have the right to act without the consent of that other parent. And it also is important to know, again, in these custody situations, you know, who's getting the notice of the IEP, you know, who's signing the IEP, and schools, you know, don't want to be in the middle of, you know, custody battles, rightfully so. So I try to encourage parents who are going through a divorce or separation, you know, to try to get together. You know, if you can't agree on anything else, you know, try to have some solid game plan in place in terms of the communication with the school, who's going to attend IEP meetings, you know, who's going to be signing, and, you know, just so that there's clear communication.
You know, that's really important information that I had never even thought of, and I would think that it's very important when you have a child receiving special education services, but even with a child who doesn't require special education services, things could be coming up later that would they would need services and they would need decisions made more than usual, and so it's a really important issue.
Oh, it comes up all the time. I mean, even a decision like I've had situations where, you know, a child was identified as gifted and the school wanted to promote the parent, you know, child, you know, have them skip a grade. And one parent agreed, thought it was a great idea, and the other parent says, no, you know, the child's not socially or emotionally mature enough to be skipped. I don't want them to skip. And there's, a, you know, a debate about that and a dispute over it. So all kinds of decisions have to be made, even for typically developing kids in school. Can they go on a field trip? You know, can they go to Astro Camp? Can they go, you know, to Washington, D.C.? And, you know, parents can widely disagree on, you know, some very simple decisions. And, again, the question comes down to who has the legal rights to make those ultimate calls. And it's, again, just not automatic that because the person with the physical custody that they also have those educational rights, and oftentimes they need to have a custody order that clearly defines it, and the school wants to see that because they need to protect themselves from, you know, liability. So really important to know. The next slide talks about related services, and in IDEA it actually talks about what related services are: transportation, developmental corrective, and other supportive services. May include one-on-one tutoring, remediation of reading, writing, spelling, and math skills. It doesn't require a child to be in special ed to receive tutoring or academic tutoring.
Does that include also speech and occupational therapy and those kinds of services?
I'm sorry?
Do related services also include occupational therapy and speech therapy?
Yes, occupational therapy, speech therapy, physical therapy, all of those are considered related services. Well, some of the ones that parents, the less obvious ones that I always tell parents about, there's a service called recreational therapy, and I always tell my parents to ask their school district if they offer rec therapy. And recreational therapy is akin to social skills. So usually they're professionals that have a background in physical education or adaptive education services, and they come onto a campus, and their job is to help that child who has special needs engage in school-appropriate recreational activities. So let's say on the playground during recess, the kids play volleyball, for instance. It's not PE time, but this is just the social time at school. And a child with, say, autism, you know, can't join in the game. They can't figure out the instructions. They can't, you know, figure out what amount of pressure to apply on the ball to make it go over the net. A rec therapist's job is to, again, help that child acquire the skills so that they can participate in those recreational activities. And we know it's so important for kids to have recreational activities during school time, because school is not just about academics. It is about social and emotional development. It is about connecting with people. And, you know, in the fourth, fifth grade, those connections usually happen around play and recreation time. So that's another related services that parents should be aware of.
You know, that's a really good point. I didn't know that, and I actually worked as a recreation therapist at a California State Hospital, Fairview State Hospital, and we did. We used recreation to help them with social skills and things to do in the community for when people were being deinstitutionalized from the state hospitals to go live in group homes. Recreation therapy was a big thing. I had no clue you could ask for that in school, but it really makes perfect sense because it's part of that whole social thing, but also the physical thing that's so important during recess and downtime out in the playground that parents have such concerns with their children about.
No, it's an incredible way for kids to connect. And what I've seen with kids with autism is recreational therapy also becomes a vehicle through which language is promoted. So, you know, if you get kids playing games, you can start to promote more language. You know, is it my turn? Is it your turn? You know, counting and, you know, all the other things that come into play when you're playing a game. It teaches, you know, listening skills and, like I said, you know, turn-taking skills and so many other skills that we know that are important, you know, to play in a game. So a very important service. And most large school districts around the country will have someone like yourself or the service that you provided when you were at that state hospital. So just important to know, you know, as something to consider as a service. The next slide, I'm very, very important slide, too, because it can include instruction in classroom, home, hospitals, and other settings. And a tip is that related services can include 40 hours of applied behavior analysis programs. So we know ABA therapy and other types of therapies are offered often in the school context, but a related service can also include a behavior program that's offered in the home. And particularly in those early intervention years when a child is not, you know, spending 6 to 8 hours a day in a classroom and may only be in school 2 or 3 hours every other day, there may be a need for them to have a home-based therapy program. And that is considered a related service that the school district might be responsible for funding. So, again, very important for parents, particularly those with younger kids. And one of the things that I use for my own son is he was fully included. And we used and requested through his IEP service hours for priming because kids who are fully
right.
included who have modified curriculum need an opportunity at home to practice. So before, you know, a math lesson is taught in the classroom, he has someone that comes to our house that, you know, brings that classwork 2 or 3 days in advance, and they practice with him the work so that when he sees it in the classroom, it's not the first exposure to it. He's comfortable with it, and that allows him to better participate in class, you know, raise his hand, answer questions, and be, you know, a greater part of that classroom experience.
You know, I have a couple of questions that people have sent in, and I didn't know if you were willing to take them right now.
No, absolutely.
Okay, we can. I don't know what your schedule is like, Ariva, but if you have extra time, we can extend since we started late. It's up to you.
No, let's go ahead. Let's go for it.
So Sylvia in El Monte, California asks, on field trips, the schools are putting on the permission slips that they release, that they release themselves from all liability. Legally, can they not take your child on a trip if you refuse to sign that form?
Well, yes, because unless the field trip is written into the IEP and it's already been, you know, particularly kids in special education, everything that kids in special education receive, we know, is in the IEP. So if it's in the IEP and it says that they are to attend field trips, and it doesn't mention the signing of this form, then I would argue that the school is obligated to comply with the IEP document. But if the field trip is not specifically listed in the IEP, then the school has the right to have as a condition proceeding, not just for the kid with special needs, but for all kids, that parents sign the release form. So what I tell parents in that situation is, particularly, again, in the context of IEPs, anything that you want or anything that happens with respect to your child in that school, included in the IEP document.
Okay. Now, Joanne Smith from Chula Vista is asking a question. It's not really about special education, but perhaps you can answer. Dear Ariva, is Area Board 13 in California still the go-to organization when needs aren't being met after trying all options with said services? If not, who do parents go to aside from a lawyer for adult special needs services?
Well, the regional center is in California's system is the go-to organization for services for adults as well as children with developmental disabilities. So if there's an adult who qualifies for regional center services because they meet, you know, the five categories of disabilities
right.
that regional centers handle, that still would be the go-to organization to look for services for that adult. Now, we know what's happening in California across the board are all of these massive cuts to the Department of Developmental Services, which is in turn causing regional centers to cut their services. But I would turn to your local regional center in that area, and if they can't provide services for the adult, they definitely should be able to make some referral for you.
Yeah, but I guess the point is, and I know what this person's referring to because I'm in the same regional center. So I'm actually gearing up for my big fight since negotiations haven't worked. Who do you go to besides area board if you need help other than area board or an attorney? In other words, if regional center is not...
It turns you down.
Correct.
You're saying. You know, the unfortunate part is there aren't a lot of options. I mean, you know, the fair hearing process that the regional centers have set up, if there's a denial of service, is still available. And there are still some public interest type advocacy groups, public counsel, disability rights organizations that provide assistance to parents when they are, you know, in disagreement with decisions made by their regional centers. But there aren't a lot. You're right. I mean, you know, there's the area board, and then there's the challenge to the fair hearing process. That's pretty much what's available to you.
I'm trying to remember the name of the actual disability office that we have here in San Diego. They've changed the names from the state. But there's disability rights that you can call for information if you don't have the money or you don't want to hire an attorney. And actually, that's what I've done in the past, just to get an idea of what my rights are.
Yes, they used to be protection and advocacy, but they changed their name.
You know what? And while you're talking, I'll look it up online, and then I'll fill you in on that, because I've just used them, and they're very good. They take a few days to get back to you, but it's a good way to check out what your rights are, you know, on a general basis, like if you have the rights, because sometimes you're told, oh, well, you don't have this right or you don't have that right. And if you just want to know, you think you have that right, but you don't perhaps really need an attorney to handhold you the whole way, but you need to know if you're correct in a certain assumption about a law, they can help you with that information.
And
so
I just want to
go ahead and talk, I'll look it up online.
And I'll say to that same parent, and I don't know if you were on the call when we started, but I started by talking about a free parent and professional conference at Special Needs Network, the nonprofit I started, is having in the Los Angeles area coming up on Friday, April 15th, and Saturday, April 16th. On the April 16th day, we actually have a workshop being taught by an attorney named Brian Capra. And Brian was with Protection and Advocacy for many, many years. He's now with a local nonprofit legal group called Public Counsel, and his sole job for the last 10, 15 years has been representing families in matters involving their regional centers. So Brian Capra will be teaching a workshop, and it's free again to parents, and if you want to find more information about that, you can go to www.specialneedsnetwork.org and register for the conference. But Brian will be walking parents through that whole regional center process and what do you do, you know, when you can't reach agreement, when services are cut, what's your recourse, and going over, like you said, Chantel, just a lot of what your legal rights are under the Lanterman Act, which is the state statute in California which governs regional center services. So you might want to, you know, maybe worth an hour and a half, 2-hour drive into LA to just have, you know, that, you know, opportunity to pick Brian's brain on this issue.
That's a good idea. And I'll just mention now that in California it's now called Disability Rights CA. So www.disabilityrights.org. And on this website, there's information, but also there are different offices, and there is one in San Diego. So you can
read.
But for others that are tuning in from other states, there is the Protection and Advocacy. And if you just Google that and Google the state, it may have a different name, but you'll find it because every state is obligated to have one. Areva?
Yes. Okay. I was letting you finish.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm done.
That's all.
I'll let the attorney speak now.
Okay. Any other questions? I'm going to go back to the slides.
Oh, go ahead to the slides.
Okay. I was finishing slide 8, so I'm on to slide 9 now. So, again, back to, we're just going through some of the key.
Hello? Areva?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, because I heard and I lost you.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. We're on slide 9, going back through some key points of our IDEA. Now, this is child fine. And as everyone knows, child fine requires school districts to identify, locate, and evaluate children with disabilities, including those in home schools, homeless, those in private schools, and those who are in juvenile courts. A tip for parents is that the child does not have to have a disability label before special education services are provided. And often we know time is lost while evaluations are being performed. You don't want to let valuable time pass before moving to the appropriate services. And basically what this means is if a child is sitting in the second grade and that child is not functioning, not keeping up with the classroom work, demonstrating that, you know, he or she is not able to follow the instructions of a teacher. They're not engaging with their peers. You know, the teacher just can't ignore that. The teacher has an affirmative obligation to, quote, unquote, child find, which is to, make some recommendations, call a parent-student assessment meeting, usually, you know, a step down before we actually get to a full IEP, but to take some action. And I've seen this happen, unfortunately, all too often, where a child has really been promoted from grade to grade to grade when there were obvious issues that were ignored by the school. And we may be into a child that's been struggling for 2 or 3 years before we actually get to the stage of doing an appropriate assessment. So schools can't just bury their heads in the sand. They have an affirmative obligation to find those kids that need special education services. Slide 10 talks about private school placement and parentally placed private schools. There are new requirements which mandate consultation between the public and the private schools. And here's just a tip on this. Courts have differed on whether public schools had to provide special education to children in private schools. We've seen that some cases where parents have been successful when they have unilaterally placed a child in private school and they've sought reimbursement for that tuition from their public school. We know that when the public school itself makes a recommendation to refer a child to private school, there really aren't any issues. When they make that recommendation, they're basically saying we cannot provide a free, appropriate public education in our public school setting, so we're referring you to a private school, and clearly in that case they're going to reimburse, or not just reimburse, they will defray and usually pay the tuition themselves. So the key is, and what I tell parents as a practical matter, is before unilaterally placing a child in a private school, you need to attend an IEP. You need to have an offer of FAPE from your public school, and you need to be able to demonstrate why that offer is less than FAPE and why your private school does meet the free appropriate public education or provides something that the public school did not provide, and that puts you in the best position of seeking any type of reimbursement for those private school tuitions. Just want to move on to 11, where we talked about assessments and IDEA, the revised version, change to state that all children with disabilities are included in general and statewide assessments with appropriate accommodations. Now, parents can request an alternative assessment be used in place of having a child participate in school statewide tests. And parents have the right to choose their own independent evaluators. And this comes up a lot, I know, because parents oftentimes will not want a child to take the standardized test at all, or they'll want them to have some significant modification. And, you know, I think it's parents have a right. I'm sorry, Chantel, what did you say?
Music. Great music in the background, Ariva.
Oh, no, I was turning down. I've been trying, but it didn't successfully, so I got rid of it. So parents just need to know that their child has a right to assessments if they want them to, and they have a right to alternative assessments, and they have a right to modification. Slide 13 talks about minority students. And IDEA, once it was revised in 2004, went through some pretty significant events to fix a problem. And the problem has been or had been the over-identification of African-American children as having MR, which is mental retardation, and ED, emotional disturbance. And they found that the rates at which kids, African-American kids, was diagnosed was larger, was greater than. And so the new, something happened, Chantel, with my slides.
Really?
Hold, yes. One second, I'm trying to get back.
See what I see on my end.
Okay. Okay. So, you know, any parents that are listening to this who, you know, have children, African-American children, and they are concerned about a labeling of MR and ED, or if they've been given that label, don't be afraid to challenge it if you think it's inaccurate, because IDEA does recognize that there's been an over-identification of children in that particular category.
So they're more identified in those categories than to be diagnosed as autism?
Yeah, I think what the statute does is, yes, to answer your question, yes, there was the consensus was that African Americans were labeled inappropriately, inaccurately, as having mental retardation. And I've seen cases where kids weren't given an autism diagnosis or eligibility standard, but rather were given eligibility under MR. And this is important because a lot of parents feel that the MR identification comes with it a set of lower expectations than the autism eligibility. And I've had parents say that, you know, they fought to get the autism eligibility because with it they felt that there were, again, higher expectations and a different sense about that child's potential for learning.
That's right.
And, you know, that is just a real concern that parents have, is that if a child is labeled MR, you know, is there going to be any expectation for this child to learn, or, is the process really going to be more about just kind of warehousing this child?
Right. In fact, when Jeremy, because Jeremy's 22, my son Jeremy, he actually had the MR plus autism diagnosis, and I quickly moved to get that removed as soon as possible. But in the old days, they actually gave that to everybody, and it's kind of a shame that they've kind of, you know, pocketed that over to other, you know, just one certain group of persons now.
Yeah, it's great that you mentioned the old days, because the old days weren't so long ago, but you're right.
I know.
In the old days, it was thought that most kids with autism had MR.
Right.
And there was a misunderstanding and totally misinterpretation that those kids, our kids, could not learn, and not a recognition that, you know, that they just learn differently. And in fact, statistically, very few kids with autism have an actual comorbidity of mental retardation. So the numbers are much, much smaller than was once thought. And the reason is, I had a psychologist / evaluator explain to me, it came about because most of the tests that are used to determine MR involve some verbal assessment. And because kids with autism, you know, usually score very poorly on verbal assessment tests, they, you know, would have a misread of MR. So with better testing now and a better understanding of how kids with autism learn, I'm not seeing that nearly as much, but you're right, it is a concern, and there are kids who would get dual eligibility labeling, and
always,
parents had to fight about it.
I always like to remind people that when my son was diagnosed at age 3, I was told to find a good institution for him, And I have. It's called college because my son graduated from high school at the age of 22 last June. Of course, he has some verbal, but he typed out everything with the rapid prompting method. He passed the California exit exam on his first try with accommodations but no modifications, and he's now attending community college, and he writes on the community college newspaper and is co-authoring his first book with me for Macmillan for next April on the transition to adult life. So he's writing the viewpoint from a person with autism who wants to be an adult, what he wants, and I'm writing the viewpoint of mom trying to help him get what he wants as an adult, which is not the same idea now as it was a couple of years ago because of all the funding flashes, but anyway, the thing is, never believe when they say your child cannot learn. I don't care how old your child is or what race your child is or what language you speak, children can learn.
And that's an excellent point, and I love the video that's gone viral of your son at his graduation and him making, you know, remarks at the graduation. And I was just talking to a group of parents in St. Louis. I just did an event called The Power of Advocacy in St. Louis, and I was telling the group that one of the most inspiring ways or things that we can do as parents is spread stories like your son's story. Think about how, you know, we're motivated. You know, we'll usually, you know, they'll be some story or some portrayal of success on television, in the newspaper or something, and, you know, someone who overcomes something, and it's a source of inspiration. I know with our kids with autism, you know, oftentimes we don't hear those success stories. We don't hear about, you know, the kid that, you know, did something, and it doesn't have to be, you know, super ginormous. You know, it could be something as simple as, hey, they graduated and they went on to college, but just hearing that can be such a source of inspiration for so many other parents. I think it's so important in our community that we post those positive success stories of kids, you know, achieving in athletics and, you know, achieving in academics and, you know, in the workplace and so many other places that we know our kids and young adults do achieve success. We've got to spread more of those positive stories out there as a source of inspiration for, you know, those folks who are just starting this journey. So thank you for sharing your son's story because it truly is inspirational. And ironically, in St. Louis, I went to a workshop that was sponsored by another advocate as a part of this whole conference that I was participating in. And she showed your son's video to a group of college students who are in a special education training program to become special ed teachers.
Well, it's interesting. Every time I show that, people ask me to bring it and I show that video, there are people in the audience crying. And I find, you know, I'm really happy that it inspires people. And I only tell the story because Jeremy is so so sure that he wants his story out there because he wants to encourage other people. And it was so much work for everyone, but nobody worked harder than Jeremy. And that's an important point that we all have to remember, that how hard it is for us as parents, but it's much harder for the person that we're helping.
Yes, but I you know, appreciate you sharing that because it truly is inspirational.
I have a couple more questions that came
in. Go ahead. Let's do it.
Okay, mm-hmm. Sylvia from El Monte, do you know if the call for action final report put together by the California Department of Education Autism Advocacy Committee is active or is it still pending?
I do not know, but I will. We can make a note of that, and I can try to find out the information, but I don't know the answer to that. I don't know the status of that.
If you email it to me, I'll make sure that Sylvia gets that if she sends me her email. And also, I just want to remind people, if you would like the slides, go to autismcollege.com and send me an email saying you want the slides to Ariva's presentation, and I'll make sure you get them. Okay, and the other question is this medication issue true for all states, or is it only true in California?
And I assume she's talking about slide 13. Got a little ahead of us. The slide said schools may not require a child to take medication in order to attend school, receive an evaluation, or receive special education. All of these slides are applicable to IDEA, which is the federal statute that governs special education, and this is the law across the country. So this isn't California law. This is the federal law. So this is definitely applicable. I'm not sure what state that parent is in, but this applies to all states. And just kind of a quick civil procedure course for you on how laws work. Federal laws can go further. Let me phrase it a little differently. State laws can provide greater services than those which federal laws provide, but the state can't provide less than what the federal provides. So if the federal law says schools can't force a child to take medication, a state law can't trump that, can't say, well, in our state, we want all of our kids to be medicated. Cannot do that. So I don't know if you're dealing with a situation where your child or someone has tried to force your child to take medication, but no, the school can't do that. And let's think about why that makes sense. I mean, we can't force adults even, and Chantel, you know this better than anyone dealing in state mental facilities, you can't force patients to take medication. It has to be completely voluntary, and even if they go bonkers when they're out off their medication, that's their choice.
That's a real problem.
It's a huge problem. We wouldn't want schools telling parents, you know, to send your kid to school, they've got to be medicated.
Yeah, because that's another problem that we've seen in IEPs. I mean, I hate to get off the topic here, but I'll just say
Go ahead.
Is that, you know, and I've heard parents tell me all this time how they start talking about perhaps some educational needs the student has and behaviors, and right away the issue of medication comes up. Well, medication should just be part of a whole program. It's not enough just to say medicate the child and then he doesn't need certain services anymore.
And, again, it should be a family decision because we
right.
know medication has so many implications for, you know, there's so many side effects and there's the cost associated with it. I mean, you know, going to a medical doctor and getting Ritalin or any of these medications isn't free. So, I mean, the school couldn't force a parent to go get health insurance to pay for medication. So, I mean, there's just so many civil rights issues involved in this.
Correct.
The school can't do that.
Okay, back to you, Ariva.
Okay, so we're moving on to slide 14 talks about early intervention services and basically just says that, again, when it talks about the law, IDEA created funding for the development of early intervention services for K-12 with the emphasis on K-3 students, for those students who need academic and behavioral assistance but who have not been identified as needing special education. Now, in California, we know we've seen our early intervention programs. There have been some reworking of a lot of our programs due to budget cuts, but this really was talking about those kids who have not been fully identified as needing special education services. The school district, not the regional centers we've seen happen in California, but the school district itself has an obligation to provide some assistance to those students. So you may have a student that doesn't have, again, true eligibility for special education, but it doesn't mean that that child cannot receive some additional assistance. Next slide, talking about evaluations, IEPs, and placement. Provision in IDEA provides that parents, school, or other state agencies may request an initial evaluation, and the evaluation must be completed within 60 days of parental consent. This is really important because I have a lot of parents often ask me about, do I have to consent for a school to evaluate my child? So let's think of how this would arise. Again, you know, little Billy's in the second grade. He's not reading. He's not writing. He's not following the class. The teacher's, you know, concerned about some behaviors. And they go to mom and dad and say, look, mom and dad, I think there's something going on with Billy. I don't know what it is, but I think we should have him evaluated by the school psychologist. The parent says, no, I don't want my child to be evaluated. The school cannot evaluate that child without consent or without some type of legal order ordering the parents to submit the child to an evaluation. So the parents have to be involved in this process. Now, what a school can do is a school can initiate a due process action against a parent if a parent fails to give consent for an evaluation for which they believe the child is entitled or the child is in need of. So you should be aware that when you deny the school consent, you should be prepared that you may have to face a legal challenge and defend the reason for your denial. Typically, though, we don't see that happening as much as we see the parents actually requesting an evaluation from the school. So, and usually the issue comes up about whether the school complies with the statutory guidelines and the evaluation is done timely. And that's where my tip is to request the evaluation in writing so that you can track the time period.
You know, that's a really good point because Areva's given us a lot of really valid information here, and I know she's making it sound like it's so easy to do, but it is easy when you're empowered with the knowledge that you know that you have these rights, and you can't be afraid. And you have to realize that these rights are here for you, and also every time that you exercise your right, you are helping other students in the system, not just your child. And also...
Yes.
Sorry, go ahead.
I thank you for making that point, because by no means do I want to suggest that any of this is easy, particularly for parents who have not been, at this very long, or, they haven't had a lot of experience with working with bureaucracies or, school administrators. But your point, Chantel, is so key, is that you can become. You don't have to start.
Right.
No one expects you to start, ready and, just so confident about this process. But by taking classes like this, by, going on websites, by reading, books, by gathering information, you become more confident about the process. You become more knowledgeable about the process, and that will empower you to be able to take these actions and steps.
Now, part of the reason why Jeremy is where he is today is because I filed for due process twice. And, when I first started out, I didn't have any more information than anybody did other than what I read, and even if you don't have money for books online, you can get things, or at libraries you can borrow these books. And the other thing that I want to say, and I'm sure Areva may be mentioning this, but documenting everything is so important, because that's how, I remember the first time that I filed for due process, I eventually had to use an attorney because for actually filing and making sure I did things correctly. She laughed when she saw my documents. She goes, oh, my God, this is so much, but you're going to win just by the fact that you've documented everything. Every time I made a phone call, every time I requested something, I wrote a letter, very nice, whatever the letter was about, and always loved Chantal, very polite, very nice. But the point is I had everything to prove every attempt that I had made. And anytime somebody called me, I had a notebook near the phone, and I wrote down what was the conversation, who I spoke to, when I called them to ask where things were. So I just had all this documentation, and, by the end of the day, you just kind of overwhelm them with the fact that they can't remember what they did or didn't do, and you know what you did and didn't do.
That is an excellent point because, in my book, The Everyday Advocate, one of my principles of advocacy is just that, is learning. One of the seven principles I talk about is learning to document everything is so, so important. And in lawyers' terms, we say if it's not in writing, it didn't happen. And, you want to get in the habit of making sure things that did happen are memorialized. And school districts are busy, and they get lots of calls, they get lots of requests, and giving them the benefit of the doubt, oftentimes things get lost in the shuffle. So your request for an evaluation, your request for a service that's made orally or over the phone may very well get lost, by a busy secretary or a busy administrator. So, don't assume that someone purposely did it.
Right.
It just may be the press of time. So you just want to get in the habit, as Chantel said, of putting all your requests in writing, submitting them to the school district, keeping copies, maintaining a file system. I tell parents, think of this whole IEP process as a business process. So when you go to a business meeting, you're going to, you know, come with a folder or a notebook or some way that your materials are organized. Likewise with an IEP, you don't want to show up with, you know, a brown paper sack with crumpled papers, you know, with your dinner on it from last night. You want to come with, you know, your materials very well organized, be it in some type of folder or some type of hole punch notebook, but some way that allows you easy access and organization so that when documents are requested, you can, you know, quickly find them.
It doesn't take
long to invest in just a good filing and organizational system.
Yeah, and you talk about that in your book, and it's so important. I was reading some of that earlier, and it's very important. And the other thing is I love Areva talking about going as if you're going to a business meeting, because I may not know all the legal things, but one thing I do know is when you go in these meetings, it is a business meeting in the sense that you are going to win whatever it is for your child based on how things are discussed and based on facts, not on emotions. So you have to go in as if you're in a business meeting with your facts. And the point is they often try to derail you by getting into all the emotional stuff. I'm not saying necessarily on purpose, but, you know, you're talking about your kid, and so they're treating you as a mom or a dad, but you want to set the tone from the beginning, you know, very nicely, but it's going to be facts because doesn't matter how you feel about something, it's whether you're right or you're wrong.
Yeah, and that's so important. I keep going back to this power of advocacy talk that I just did in St. Louis because we covered this. I actually made a list on a big chalkboard. It was about 250 people at this workshop, and I said, you know, we're going to make a list of all the things that an effective advocate is and all the things that an effective advocate aren't. I just wanted one word characteristics, and the word emotional was thrown out on the not list, what an advocate is not. And I said, you know, on first glance, most people probably would agree with you. I said, but truly, in actuality, emotion can be good. It's just a question of how and when to use it.
Right.
And that's what advocates have to learn to do. It's something called emotional intelligence. So you have to know that there may be an appropriate time in an IEP to cry. It's just when is it? There may be an appropriate time to, you know, be a little more forceful, but it's just when is it? Now, clearly, if you walk in the door and before, you know, two words are uttered and you're crying and you cry throughout the whole event, probably not, you know, a good use of your emotions. Probably, you know, didn't accomplish what you set out to accomplish. So you have to be really careful about your emotions. And your point is well taken, is that when you go with your facts, and you're leading with your facts and not leading with your emotion, you're much more likely to be heard, you're much more likely to be respected, not to be dismissed, and for you to be given, you know, the kind of due consideration that you want as an important part of the IEP team, which is something, you know, I haven't said that I should say, parents, you are a vital part of the IEP team. And indeed, an IEP is to be a collaborative team process. So your input, your questions, your comments are as important as those as the person that is a 20-year experience PhD. And don't feel because you don't have certain letters behind your name or you haven't been an educator or you haven't been, you know, to school to study psychology that you're not important. You are in some ways most important because you know your child. And you know your child better than anyone sitting at that table. They may spend 6 hours a day with your child. Guess what? You spend the other 18 hours a day with your child. So you are truly the expert, and you don't have to have a big vocabulary. You don't have to know complex, you know, terms. You don't have to remember all this stuff about IDEA, but you have the most important information that's needed to make a decision, and that's information about your child's strengths as well as their areas where they need assistance. So very important to remember.
And we have about 20 more minutes, and I have one more question that came in here.
Okay.
What do you do if the school refuses to recognize an autism diagnosis because they claim they do not see it in the school setting, and the signs that are there, they are refusing to relate them to autism, and the child is testing in the intellectual disability range? And as a parent, you try to tell them that the autism is impeding on the learning and causing the low scores, but this is something they refuse to acknowledge. What do you or can you do?
Very good question, because now we're talking about dueling assessments. So parent goes in, and I assume this parent has gotten a private assessment from some outside evaluator that says this child has autism, and let's assume the school has done its own either formal or informal assessment and says we don't see it. And I've had a case like this, and a little girl whose scores were above average and who the school said participated in classroom activities, et cetera, and they saw absolutely no signs of autism. They had their own school psychologist do an assessment. Mom had gone to one of the local hospitals and had had a doctor do an outside assessment, and outside assessment said autism. So classic example of school assessment and parents' assessment disagreeing, being inconsistent. First thing is, parents, when you get an outside assessment, you need to make sure that the assessor is qualified to do school-based assessments. That's a question you need to ask before you give someone $1,000, $1,500, $2,500. Some of these assessments cost $3,000 to $5,000. Before you spend your precious, precious money, ask some smart questions. And one of the smartest questions is, what is your experience in evaluating school children in a school context for a particular disability or for any disability? And the reason that is important is because there are practitioners, there are evaluators who do what's called clinic-based assessments, and there are others who do school-based assessments. And clinic-based assessments aren't applicable in a school context because the school's obligation is only to provide an environment for a child to make academic progress. So the evaluator needs to strengthen and to have the strongest report is to evaluate that child in the school. So the evaluation can start in an office away from school, but at some point the best evaluation will take into account some observation in the classroom setting. And now why do you ask? Because if you go to hearing on this matter, if you ultimately have to go to a due process hearing and you have some neutral administrative law judge looking at this. Judges look at evidence. So if I have two reports and one is written from an evaluator that spent 5 hours studying this child in the school setting and one has no observation of the child in the school setting, just by definition, the one with the school setting observation is going to carry more weight. Because the judge is going to say, well, how can you say little Mary can't follow the teacher when you never observe little Mary in the classroom? So that's very important. So I would ask that mom what the question is, did that autism assessment that was done that you're relying upon, does it include an observation in the school setting? Does it include, you know, some type of evaluation of that child's performance at school? If not, I would have my assessor go back and do that and update the assessment, because ultimately that assessment is going to not be as weighed as heavily in an ultimate legal battle. And let's assume now you've done that, you have your thorough assessment that includes that component, and the school still disagrees. You have the right to challenge the school's failure to or unwillingness to find an eligibility by filing a request for due process and stating that you requested an IEP, you attended an IEP, you requested that an eligibility determination for autism be provided to the child on the basis of the report of Dr. X, and the school refused, and the school is in violation of IDEA and its child find requirement by not finding this child eligible for special education services. And the school will ultimately have to respond to that. A step before that would be asking the school to conduct an independent evaluation, and that's where a school and you will decide upon some outside assessor. So the school just won't accept your report, and it won't rely on the report of its internal doctor, but some third-party assessor will be selected to do an evaluation. and then that evaluation will be brought back to the IEP to determine whether there's an eligibility.
So she writes back in this person and says, so a doctor's diagnosis carries no weight in the school setting?
No, that's not what I said. I said the weight that's given is going to be determined on the thoroughness of any report. So is this doctor familiar with educational code? Is the doctor familiar with IDEA? Is the doctor familiar with what the school's obligations are, and does the report take all of that into consideration? Some doctors dedicate their entire practices to evaluating kids in school, like Dr. Ricky Robinson, who we talked about a little earlier. There are other doctors who are pediatricians who have no clue about school law, IDEA, or what's required for schools in the context of providing an education for children with special needs.
Here's one more question. It's from Sandra in Los Angeles. I'm in due process with my district, and we privately placed my child during the process. The private school has now dropped my child because they don't want to go to court. Is this going to hurt my child's case?
That's an interesting question. When you say drop your child, the school will be, I assume the administrators at the school will be subpoenaed, which is a legal process by which someone is compelled to testify. And your case is going to be whether the private school setting allowed your child to make academic progress and and the public school setting that was offered was not a free, appropriate public education, that the offer by the school in the public school setting didn't meet the standards of FAPE, and that this private school setting did. The dropping of the kid is kind of a side issue because it doesn't tell us very much about the progress that the child made in that school setting. And I assume the school is not going to come and say we kicked the kid out of the school because they weren't making progress. But I don't know how they explain that they, you know, put the kid out of the school.
Right. If they subpoena, they still have to answer.
Right. But are they going to say we kicked the kid out because we didn't want to be involved in a legal fight? Or, you know,
right.
It's a little dicey. Nice if your lawyer or whomever is representing you can interview and get a better insight into what the school's, you know, explanation will be for why the kid is no longer there. But, you know, assuming that the child made academic progress, the kicking out, it just sounds like a red herring to me because, I don't know, it sounds like there's probably more there, and the parents need to investigate that a little further. I can't imagine that a school puts a child out, because to avoid a legal entanglement. That sounds a little, there's probably something there.
Yeah. Okay, I keep saying one last question, but someone else has one now from New York City. And then we have 10 minutes left, and so you'll have to decide if you want to go back to your slides and finish up, probably. I'm not sure.
Yep. You tell me.
Okay, so one more question, then you can go and wrap up with your slides, and if I see more coming in and you want to take them, we'll take them.
Okay.
Okay, so this is Arlene Alvira in New York City. Can you request to observe your child's class if you have a concern within the classroom?
Absolutely. Parents, and I encourage parents to do this even before there's a concern. You know, again, when we place our typical kids in school, we are frequently visiting. We're volunteering in the classroom. We're making cookies. We're going on the field trips. The same should happen with respect to our special needs child. We want to be respectful of the school's schedule and their their protocol for visitors on the campus, but you should always feel free to arrange for observation time of a classroom. And I like to encourage parents to have regular meetings with staff outside of the IEP, quick monthly meetings, 30-minute updates, you know, so that all parties involved in the child's education can touch bases, everybody know what's going on. But observations are a big part of parents being tuned in to what's happening with a kid at school and then being able to support the child. I think what happens with the observation process is that parents get weird about it, teachers get weird about it, and then all of a sudden there's this, you know, he's spying on me, and no one wants to be spied on their job kind of thing happens. But what I tell parents is approach it in a much more positive way is, Miss Teacher, you know, I want to be able to support little Billy at home. It would be really helpful for me if I could come and observe him in the classroom and see some of the things that you're doing in the classroom and how he responds to them so that I can continue that learning process, you know, after school. Now, that's a very non-threatening request. That's a compliment to the teacher. You know, that's much more likely to get, sure, versus, you know, I don't like what's going on in this classroom, and my child comes home and blah, 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 and, you know, I want to come up and see what you're doing in the classroom. Sometimes that emotion taking over.
Right.
You may be feeling all of that, but, you know, you've got to learn, again, my emotional intelligence. I'm going to go back to that again and again. You know, teachers are human, and we get a lot more, you know, bees with honey.
Yeah. So someone just texted in, I don't request to come to the class. I just show up. It's my kid. If they don't like it, it's their problem.
I'm sorry, someone requested to come, say that again for me?
Someone just typed in, I don't request to come to the class, I just show up. It's my kid. If they don't like it, it's their problem.
Well, that's not actually true. You know, yes, you have a right to visit the campus, but the school also has a right to control who shows up. Now, you wouldn't just want parents showing up, observing class, the classroom that your child is in. The school has a right to maintain some order, to know who's on campus, which is why they stop you at the front gate. There are security measures in place. There may be other kids in the classroom. Those kids have a right to privacy. So, yes, you have some rights, but so do the other kids in that classroom, and so does the school have rights in terms of setting protocols that don't disrupt the classroom or disrupt the teacher. Now, ultimately, you can accomplish the same thing. But so much of this, and I tell parents, you know, advocacy is a marathon. It's not a sprint. If you have a child in a school, they're going to be there, what, 5, 6, 8, maybe 10 years. You're in a long-term relationship with these people. So unless you need to escalate it, don't. Why?
That's a really good point, and I think that from the parent point of view who's not an attorney, that's something I struggled with hiring an attorney for the time, the twice that I went to and I filed for due process. But so I picked, of course, the attorney who usually won, but I was also cognizant that I want an attorney who is not going to cut everybody's down to hating the fact that they had to deal with her and deal with the situation, because I knew that I was going to have to be back there continuing a relationship with the school district. So that's a really important thing to remember.
Yes.
When you're hiring an attorney or an advocate, you know.
And when you're dealing yourself with staff, this is a collaborative process.
Exactly.
This is teamwork. Doesn't mean that you don't assert your legal rights. It doesn't mean that, you know, you don't be the most aggressive and the most, you know, ardent advocate for your child, but it does mean, again, that you use emotional intelligence and that you're strategic and that you pick your battles. Some things are not worth getting into a battle over. It's just not worth it. Either you're not going to win, or what you do win is not worth what you lose in the process. And, you know, again, this isn't just school stuff. This is life. I mean, this is your job. I mean, you know, things happen on our job daily that we don't like, that we wish weren't the way that they are, and we have to decide, am I going to, you know, risk losing my job? Am I going to get into a tiff with my boss over this? Is it worth it? And you have to ask yourself that in this context as well, because sometimes the answer will be no. It's just not worth it. And I can tell you, as again, going back, taking off my lawyer role, putting on my parent role, that you get so much more. If you can win the staff over, if you can get them working as advocates on behalf of your child, you know what? Now that child doesn't have just one advocate. They have a team of advocates at that school intervening, interceding, and standing up for them. And that's what you do as an effective advocate. You get other people working on your behalf. I had a colleague of mine tell me that the success for her in business was that her clients were her biggest source of referrals because they did all the work for her. So they got her other clients because they talked to their friends and colleagues about how great her work was. So that's a similar concept in this area, is if you can get the teachers saying, oh, my God, I love that kid. I love working with that family. Every time I have an opportunity to, I'm going to look out for that kid. That's what you want to have happen. Now, that's not going to be the case in every situation, but more often than not, if you go into it with that frame of mind, most teachers, and I'm going to go out there and I say this because I've worked with hundreds and thousands of them really across the country, they are there because they love kids.
Exactly.
They are there because they want to be there. Many of them have master's degrees, PhDs. They could be employed in other professions and make a lot more money. But they're there because they want to be there. Now, there are, like in any profession, bad teachers, mean teachers, unqualified, incompetent, you know, but that would be true of every profession, nurses, doctors, lawyers, you know, pastors, you know, we can go down a list. But for the most part, you know, I have found that teachers want to do a good job. And as the captain of your child's ship, as the head advocate, it's your job to bring out the best in them.
That's right. And one thing I have found that works, we've been pretty blessed with the teachers. It's usually been with administration that we've had more of our disagreements with. Because, you know, some of the teachers' hands are tied as well. But I always, usually before going to IEPs, I always talk with the teachers and I say, what do you need so that you can do your job better for my son or for the others in the class? Because the thing is, they often can't ask for things because it's their boss that they're dealing with. Whereas you as a parent have more rights, actually, than the teacher does in terms of requesting what they need to provide the FAPE for the children in the classroom. And so that's a good way to form advocates in the classroom when they know that, yes, you are concerned for the child, but you're really concerned about how can you support the teacher?
So I mean, and just, again, think about how anyone would feel when that's the first question is, I'm here to support you. I want my child to be successful, and I know in order for that to happen, you have to feel supported. I mean, you're just going to start that relationship with someone saying, gee, wow, this person really respects me, you know. That's you're going to go to the front of the class, you know, versus, again, coming in with an adversarial tone. So just an important notice. I want to just move really quickly, Chantel, through some of the slides. I know we're going to make them available to those that can't access them, but 17 is really important, and it's a new provision that was included in the revised IDEA, and it's on written notice. And it says the school districts must provide in writing to parents any reason for refusing to evaluate a child or to change his or her placement. This is really, really important. And I'm going through a similar situation now with my son where service was removed from his IEP at a meeting that I wasn't at, and I didn't get written notice. I didn't get in advance a written notice from the district stating why they were changing his placement with a description of the rationale behind the denial. And this is many schools. They know this provision exists, but because of, resources and attention to detail, they miss this. And this is important for parents to know because it's a winning point for you if you do have to get to a due process challenge. And because in my son's case they didn't provide it, they are now willing to go back to the table, to the IEP process, and, you know, for us to work through this issue. So parents, be aware, you know, if school wants to change a service or they want to deny you access or deny the child access to a service, they've got to give you this in writing. I'm going to skip to 19, talks about the attendance at IEP not required by all members of the team. Certain team members can often be excluded. IEPs can be amended in writing without a particular IEP team member being present. The IDEA also now allows for mediation meetings and due process resolution sessions, maybe by conference call. talks IEP meetings. Placement cannot be made unilaterally. Again, has to be made as a IEP collaborative decision. Slide 21 talks about present level of performance. Again, very important. The IEP must include a statement of the child's present levels of academic achievement and functional performance. That was very important.
I'm back on. I lost you for 2 minutes. I don't know what happened.
Oh, I'm not sure. I'm on slide 23. IEP must include a statement of the special education and related services. This is really important. When I made the comment earlier about for lawyers, if it's not in writing, it didn't happen. We know in the IEP process, if it's not in that IEP, you're not entitled to it. So parents, you've got to be very diligent in terms of reading the final IEP before you sign it. So you may have a discussion about recreational therapy or speech therapy and sign a document and it's not included because maybe there was just a discussion but there wasn't an actual offer of FAPE that included those particular services. So you have to really make sure you comb the IEP document, particularly that service page, to make sure all the services that were discussed are included. Because that's the only way that, again, legally you can obligate the school to actually provide it. How are we doing, Chantel, for time, and do we have any other questions?
There are no more questions, but we have probably about 10 minutes.
Okay.
Yes, 10 minutes.
Okay. I want to go to slide 38 and talk about the due process complaint. The due process complaint is essentially the way that IDEA is written allows parents to challenge their school district. So if you're in an IEP meeting and the district's offer of FAPE, that free appropriate public education, is to have your child in a segregated classroom for the entire school day, and you requested that your child be in a mainstream classroom or that they're in typical ed half the day and maybe in a segregated class the other half. So now you have a classic disagreement over placement. You've been to the IEP. The district has given you its rationale. They've reviewed assessment reports. Perhaps you've brought some reports from outside evaluators, or maybe you're just relying on the district's reports and you have a different interpretation of what those reports mean. But now you have a classic dispute over placement. You've tried to work through it, but you cannot. The district refuses to accept your placement request, and you refuse to concede to the placement that's been offered. Parents have a right to file a request for due process. Essentially, it's an administrative law complaint that's filed that goes to an administrative law office with judges. Typically, mediations are tried or offered, a voluntary process whereby a mediator will try to get the parties to reach compromise, and ultimately, if no compromise is reached, the parents will have a hearing. Now, parents can file, we know, for due process without a lawyer or an advocate, or they can retain an advocate or lawyer. And I often get asked the question, you know, is it wise to go to due process without a lawyer? The answer is no, and here's why. The district, first of all, is going to be represented by attorneys. IDEA is a very complex body of law, and the due process proceeding is a legal proceeding where you have to present evidence. You have to cross-examine witnesses. Evidence is weighed for credibility. Evidence can be excluded based on certain evidentiary rules. So it could be a very technical process. And, you know, a lay person trying to present a case against a lawyer can be challenging. Now, the reality is a lot of families don't have the financial wherewithal or resources to hire an attorney, or maybe some of the public interest groups have long waiting lists and you can't readily access an attorney. There are lots of reasons why someone may not be able to access an attorney. But, you know, again, if you are able to and know that IDEA has a provision for the reimbursement of your attorney's fees, So if you are the prevailing party as the parent, the attorney's fees that your attorney expended to represent you, you would be entitled for that, for your fees to be reimbursed. So that is one provision that is helpful to parents.
That hasn't changed yet. I thought that they were trying to change it in that they weren't allowed to have the reimbursement.
No, parents are still allowed. The law still provides for the reimbursement of attorney's fees if you are the prevailing party.
Right. So that was my gamble. I figured, I mean, I really studied it really well, but I thought that after a certain point, I was also afraid that I would make mistakes because there are certain things that if you do incorrectly, then you've already put yourself in a bad light legally. And so I decided at what point I really needed to have an attorney, and then I just figured, you know, I had a, like, in my mind, an 85% chance of winning. So I thought it was a good gamble.
And again, I tell parents, you know, and you were very smart. You calculated the risk. You calculated the chances of a successful outcome. And I tell parents to do that. I mean, 95% or more of the due process complaints that are filed are actually settled in mediation. A very small percentage actually go through to a complete hearing. Unfortunately, in California, over the last several years, most of the decisions have been, the majority of the decisions have been against parents and in favor of districts. And that's important information for you to know, depending on the state you're in. You know, what kinds of cases are decided in favor of parents? Those cases that have not been, how is my case different? You know, that's as lawyers, when we're looking at filing any kind of lawsuit, one of the things we always want to know, how are these cases being decided, particularly if it's, you know, going before a jury or a certain judge? How are judges or jurors deciding these cases, you know, on facts similar to mine? Because that's going to be a good window. That's going to be a good look for me in terms of what the likely outcome of my case is. So something to keep in mind.
We have 5 more minutes.
Okay. We are going to then go to... I want to go to slide 30, and this is what I called creating your advocacy IDEA notebook. We talked about the importance of being organized, the importance of documentation. I suggest that every parent have a notebook of sorts, a folder, a notebook, and that in it you have a summary of IDEA. You can get that off of any website. You can go to rightslaw.com. They have a lot of information about, you know, the legal provisions that govern special education. You have a checklist that includes all of your child's assessments, report cards, samples of work, any medical history, the prior IEPs, all of your written documents that you've sent to the school, everything that the school has sent to you. Get yourself a good glossary of terms. There are a lot of acronyms in special education, IEP, OT, PT. You need a quick reference guide to know what all of those terms are so that when they're being used in an IEP meeting, you're tracking and you're following what's happening. Get some good sample letters. In the Everyday Advocate, at the back of the book, I provide a lot of sample letters as well as a glossary of terms. So you just have templates on your computer, so when you need to request an assessment, you need to request an IEP, it's not an overwhelming task because you already have this information on your computer. Really useful, you know, to have. And my last slide, I just quote Dr. Norman Vincent Peale, and he says, you can if you think you can. And I just want to encourage all the parents that are listening or who will listen to this, you know, this process is not nearly as overwhelming as it may appear, and as long as you think you can, trust me, you can. And I just encourage all of you to continue in your advocacy journey and know that the work that you're doing on behalf of your child is not just changing that child's life, but it's really laying the foundation for a change that will impact the lives of hundreds, if not thousands, of other kids with special needs. Thank you.
Very good point. Thank you so much, Aretha. Would you like to repeat your website addresses for both your book and also Special Needs Network?
Yes. You can contact Special Needs Network by going to www.specialneedsnetwork.org. You can get information about the upcoming free parent conference, April 15th and April 16th. And you can get more information about me and the Everyday Advocate, my book that was released by Penguin this April, by going to www.areva.com. And I'm also very active on Facebook and LinkedIn, so go to my fan page on Facebook. Contact me on LinkedIn. I provide a lot of information on my fan page about advocacy, about special education rights, and current things that are happening in the disability community.
And I wanted to say for those who are still listening on that Areva's publisher, which is the same publisher as mine, Penguin, offered us a book to give away. So whoever is still listening to this live, not the recorded but the live, if you would like to be considered for a drawing for a free copy of The Everyday Advocate, email me at autismcollege.com. So when you go to autismcollege.com, there's a page for contacting me. So it's just autismcollege, one word, .com. Say that you're interested in the drawing for The Everyday Advocate, and please include your address, your mailing address, and your email. And thank you so much, Areva, for taking the time out of your busy schedule and away from your family on the weekend to answer these questions. Again, I apologize about the technical difficulties, but everyone can email me as well for the slides. Thank you so much, Areva.
Oh, thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Thank you for all you do for the community.
Oh, thank you, Chantel, for this fantastic opportunity.
And for everyone else who's listening, go out there and be the change that you would like to see. Thank you, and enjoy the rest of your day. Bye now.